All right, so good morning, everyone. All right, here's our biblical uses of money, as we've been talking about. Remember, our first week was an overview and a biblical worldview of the faithful steward. Then we looked at earning, living, and giving. And this week, we're going to focus on the owing, the use of money to pay back debt owed to a lender. So I hope this is useful for you. And as I said, for some, it may be eye-opening, and we want to submit all of our financial life, everything in it, to the Lord, including our debt. Just remember our different heart attitudes that we've been examining as well, and these are a bit more in the order of the foundations and moving through the transformation of our hearts. From pride to gratitude, coveting to contentment, anxiety to trust, indifference to love. But you can see there is no reference here necessarily to debt. So we looked, you can attach earn, live, give, and grow to these. But in a sense, I'm just highlighting all of that because our relationship to debt can severely hamper all of these. So they are impacted by all of them. So that book, True Riches, Cortinas and Baumer, they focus on these four. I'm going to add a fifth today in response to debt. So we're going to take a look at that in a minute. One that they don't really cover, but I think it will make sense. And so our focus is going to be on owing as a faithful steward. And I'm going to start with this quotation here from Romans 13:8. Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. For he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. This passage does not mean that debt is wrong, that owing something is wrong. If that were the case, it would contradict a multitude of other scriptures, particularly references to the righteous man who lends to the poor. So if that were wrong, we would not have a verse like this. The meaning here is really, if you are to owe anything that will be ongoing and perpetual, it is the debt of love. That is a good debt to have. So owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. That is our obligation, is to love one another. And that should be an ongoing obligation, not a negative thing. So if you're going to owe anything, owe the debt of love to one another. This is a new spiritual transformation that you have not seen before, but I want to add it here, from a heart of impatience to a heart of patience when it comes to debts. Now, I know in a room like this, we're going to have all kinds of variety. We're going to have people who have no debts. We're going to have people who have some debts. We are people who are facing seemingly insurmountable debts, and I'm not going to be focusing necessarily on those who are in debt because of like maybe major medical expenses or something like that. I want to talk more about, you know, the consumer debts that our society pushes on us. Doesn't mean we're not going to focus on other types of debt at all, but we want to kind of focus on those things that grab our hearts and divert our hearts and our attention away from the Lord as far as debt is concerned. But a debt can reflect a heart of impatience versus a heart of patience. So we want to focus first of all here on a heart of impatience. And we're going to look at this passage in a couple of different ways. The first way, we want to see how a heart of impatience is manifested here in this passage, Psalm 37, verses 7 through 11. So let me read that here. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him, and just take note of those highlighted portions. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who carries out wicked schemes. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret, it leads only to evil doing. For evildoers will be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord, they will inherit the land. Yet a little while, and the wicked man will be no more. and you will look carefully for his place, and he will not be there. But the humble will inherit the land and will delight themselves in abundant prosperity." You can see the heart of patience versus impatience in this passage. It's not necessarily speaking about debt, but there is application here. There's application because often we look at those who prosper, and not necessarily because of evil, but we look at those who prosper and say, "I want to be like that." And so we try to acquire things and homes and cars and material items to make us appear like the prosperous person because we're impatient. We want those things now. And so in order to get them, our society says, "You can have them. Just fill out this credit card application. You can have anything you want, anytime you want. Don't worry about the implications of that. Live for today. Live for your pleasure now and obtain whatever you want because we can get it for you. Never mind the atrocious rates that we're going to charge you, what we're going to take from you in order to get paid for those things that you have purchased now and will pay over many years sometimes." Some more passages here. Proverbs 21:17. "He who loves pleasure will become a poor man. He who loves wine and oil will not become rich." Someone who likes to the enjoyments of life and the here and the now is not going to become wealthy because they spend everything now and often overspend because they want what they want now and they want to enjoy what life has to offer to such a degree that they never think about the future. It's always about the now and the enjoyment of whatever I can get. Proverbs 25:28. "Like a city that is broken into and without walls is a man who has no control over his spirit." And in this context that we are speaking in of debt and owing, this certainly has application. There's a reason why all of those items you see at the checkout are there, right? They're called impulse items. "Oh, I gotta have that, gotta buy that." Just because those people who market those things and place them where they do, they know that they will get sales because people buy on impulse. So there are items there that you probably didn't really need, but because it's right there and convenient, right at your fingertips, you put it on the conveyor belt and add to your expenses, what you did not even plan to buy. A here, the heart of impatience is restless because it is filled with covetousness. Cortinas and Baumer write here, "Perhaps the prevalence of consumer debt in our culture is merely the symptom of a deeper hidden problem. Could there be a sin pattern that is so pervasive, so normalized, that we're blind to it? Even as it consumes our lives and hinders our ability to connect with and serve God? The sin of coveting." Now, living on credit is not true wealth. It's a false wealth. It's giving that picture, that image to others that you possess something that you do not possess. And living on credit is often an indicator of a lack of self-control, as indicated by these verses. Letter B here. The heart of impatience is unwilling to wait to obtain what it wants now. Impatience is closely related to discontentment and covetousness. We're just going to continue on this line of thinking here. The heart of impatience is lazy and unwilling to plan for the future because it's living in the here and now and not thinking about the future. The heart of impatience prefers the appearance of wealth above the reality of wealth. Again, wanting people to see you as something that you are not, presenting a false image. The heart of impatience can lead to an overwhelming load of debt, creating a self-imposed bondage and a sense of hopelessness from ever being able to climb out from under that burden of that debt. Yet our society does nothing to lift that burden. Our society wants to add to that burden. Next, the heart of impatience makes foolish and unnecessary purchases. It robs one of the ability to change one's mind about the object of purchase, either to purchase something else instead or not purchase at all. If you've taken some basic economics, you probably heard the term opportunity cost, right? If I have a choice between A and B, and I buy A, and that's all the money I have, I cannot buy B. I've taken away any choice. I can only buy A. I can't do one or the other. Opportunity cost. There's a limitation to the amount of resources we have. And so when we make choices, it cuts off other options. That make sense? The heart of impatience tends to purchase more than can be paid back. The heart of impatience tends to purchase objects that depreciate in value rather than appreciate in value. So purchasing a depreciating asset on credit results in two negatives. The assets depreciate in value themselves, becoming worth less and less, and the interest paid on the depreciating asset makes it more expensive to possess. So when I talk about a depreciating asset, like when you buy a car, you buy a new car, drive it off the lot, immediately you've got 10, 20% depreciation. So it's worth less and less over time, that vehicle, unless we're in a COVID crisis with supply chain issues and the chips can't be provided, then those used cars became more expensive. But typically, when you purchase something like that, it depreciates in value, becomes worth less and less, but yet you're paying more and more for it because if you bought it on payments, the interest is racking up and you're paying more. So you see what you paid for it versus the day you drove it off the lot, and you probably paid a lot more for it than you had ever anticipated. But we live in a payment mentality society. Can you afford the payment? Not how much are you paying overall, but can you afford the payment? That's what everyone asks. Because if you can afford the payment, again, you can have just about whatever you want. So just be careful about, you know, purchasing depreciating assets versus appreciating assets. Now, I know someone like Dave Ramsey would say all debt is bad, right? It's all evil. It's all bad. Let's take a mortgage, for example. You take out a mortgage on a home. What typically happens to the home over the long term over time? It appreciates in value, not depreciates. Certain circumstances could cause homes to depreciate. Certain market cycles, certain elements in that could cause a home to depreciate. But typically, the home appreciates. So you're buying on credit, you're buying with a mortgage, and your asset is appreciating in value. That might be what I would call a judicious use of debt. So today we're not saying all debt is evil. Debt in and of itself is not evil. It is simply a tool that can be used. But there's a wise use of debt and there's foolish use of debt. And we want to make sure that we understand the difference between those. So this is a heart of impatience, and as it is applied to debt and the desire to have whatever we want, when we want it, as quickly as possible so that we can enjoy it. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Let me turn to a heart of patience. Same passage here in Psalm 37, but focusing now, highlighting the portions here that focus on patience. So, in verse 7, rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. And it continues on there, do not fret, etc. Verse 9, but those who wait for the Lord, they will inherit the land. And verse 10, and will delight themselves in abundant prosperity. The humble will delight themselves in abundant prosperity. It is an act of humility to wait on the Lord, to be patient, to allow him to cause the circumstances to be favorable for you in a time when he most determines that it would be best for you, versus being impatient and moving ahead of the Lord, trying to get ahead of him. Another passage here, 1 Timothy 6, 6 through 8. But godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. And even we could add in patience there. If we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. If we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. Patience, again, is closely related to contentment. The content person can also be characterized as a patient person. But contentment says, I have everything that I need. And the Lord provides for me every day, and he's promised to, and he will. When we get ahead of that, and we turn those wants into so-called needs, that's when we can get into quick trouble when it comes to debt. We've looked at this passage before, Hebrews 13:5. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have, for he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. Do you really believe the promise that God gives to us, that he will never desert us, he will never forsake us? If you believe that, then you can live out a content life, a life that is free from the love of money. Not free from money, but free from the love of money. That desire to have money instead of God, that desire to have more instead of being content. So after those verses, let's look at a few points here. The heart of patience is at rest versus the heart of impatience, which is not at rest because it is filled with contentment. Cortinas and Baumer here, another quote. Contentment, in contrast to the endless striving above, i.e. the desire for more and more, is a posture of the heart that rests peacefully in our present circumstances, no matter what they look like. It's a healing balm that helps us feel satisfied rather than restless. But it can be hard to grasp, especially when we live in a culture driven so much by a consumer mentality. Right? Again, as I've already said, our society tells us that you are discontent because you don't have this thing, or you don't have the latest version of this thing. And in order to be happy, you have to have that thing, because that thing will make you happy. Until the next version comes along, and we're going to tell the whole story all over again so that you will be discontent and get the latest version instead of finding contentment in what you have and being at rest, being at peace. So it's difficult when the society bombards us with these messages. We have to maintain our focus upward on the Lord and our meditation on his word and his promises. It's the only way you're going to find that contentment and peace and patience. Point B here. The heart of patience is content, having been diligent to plan and save for the future. The deferred enjoyment is greater and lasts longer than the quick fix of temporal happiness, of an impulsive purchase that is followed soon thereafter by the sorrowful burden created by the debts. They don't tell you about the debt that's coming afterwards and the payments that are coming and the interest that will be charged to you. So it's a very quick fix, very temporal fix. But then the debt comes and you feel the pain of that. Letter C, the heart of patience waits in dependence upon the Lord and exercises the discipline necessary to save to make a purchase later with cash rather than now with debt. Or maybe not even at all. So if we are relying upon the Lord and we come across something that we desire to buy, well, Lord, if I don't have the money, guess what? I can't buy that thing. I need to wait. I need to save for it instead of going into debt to have it now. The heart of patience builds character and enjoys the purchased object more due to the hard labor required to save the funds necessary for the purchase. I think we try to teach that to our children, right? Delayed gratification. And when they finally have the money to buy it, then they make that purchase, they take better care of it, and they tend to appreciate it more, and it's something that they worked hard for. And so they take ownership of that and can enjoy it. And we can see principles like this in Ecclesiastes, that our labor, we are to enjoy the fruits of our labor. Letter E, the heart of patience is also a heart at peace due to the freedom experienced because the choices have been made that have led one to one or more of the following. So someone who's patient and they wait to make their choice. So debt is being used judiciously and appropriately to make a useful purchase that appreciates in value over time. Example we've already given of a house, a residence. Or debt is being used sparingly in order to leverage an investment that appreciates over time, like a rental property. Sometimes that may be a wise investment versus getting too heavy into debt. Or three, overall debt is minimal or there's no debt at all. So these are kind of some of the choices that the patient person might make. A judicious use of debt, using debt sparingly, or basically no debt at all. That's a choice that you have to make. And I talked about a car, and I know that it's nearly impossible to buy a car on cash with how expensive they are. So I understand that many of us here in this room may say, yeah, we have debt from our car, but I just understand what's going on there. If you do make car payments, what's going on? Is this a judicious use? It may be what we see as a necessary use, but sometimes we don't understand the implications of that. All right, so that's really looking at this heart of impatience, turning it into patience as we rely upon the Lord, as we meditate on his promises, as we wait on him to provide us with everything that we need, and he certainly does that. Next, this might be a little bit more painful, credit and debt statistics. There's no doubt that we live in a debt-driven society. I think all of us in this room would agree on that, and from our government down, right? And it's interesting, this last election cycle, nobody wanted to touch the debt or the deficit. We've got this DOGE, right? The Department of Government Efficiency, whatever that's going to be. We'll see what that does. And big promises, Elon Musk says we're going to trim $2 trillion. Impossible. Impossible. It's not going to happen, right? All of our debt is mainly going to pay Social Security, Medicare, and interest on the debt we already have. It's a huge portion. So just realize that a lot of that is political rhetoric. Hopefully they can cut something. But the reality is we are so far in debt that who knows if we've reached the point of no return yet as a nation. We'll see. But we know, even beyond that, that the Lord cares for us. He will take care of us. So we don't have to fret about that. We don't have to worry. Howard Dayton has said this: we have so much personal debt in our nation that the average person has been described as someone driving on a bond-financed highway in a bank-financed car fueled by charge card-financed gasoline going to purchase furniture on the installment plan to put in his mortgage company-financed home. Right? True? Very true. Very true. Larry Burkett adds here: one of the first things I realized as I began to read God's word was the contrast between what the Bible taught about money and what I had been taught in business school. The primary principle taught throughout most business schools is called OPM, means other people's money. Use other people's money to finance your projects. In our economy today, it might also be described as the credit mentality, the ability to borrow that allows people to buy things they cannot afford to own. Use of other people's money. You think that credit card you're using It just belongs to a faceless company. But you're borrowing. You're still borrowing from someone. And so you're using other people's money. Number two, the debt load in the U.S. is staggering, as demonstrated by the following statistics. I tried to get the latest stats here. The average debt per U.S. household in the following categories. Average mortgage debt. So this is per household, except for number two, because it has per borrower. There may be more than one borrower for education in a household. So mortgage debt per household, $245,000. Average for the U.S. household. Student loan debts. And we're probably going, wow, $245,000. That's a lot. That's less. That's cheap for California. Right? Student loan debt per borrower in U.S. household, over $38,000. Auto loan debt per U.S. household, almost $24,000. And credit card debt per U.S. household, $6,500 average per household. So a lot of debt in this country. Looking at total debt for the country now, in the U.S., $13 trillion in mortgages, $1.74 trillion in student loans, $1.644 trillion in auto loans, $1.166 billion in credit card debt. And if you've been watching anything at all, you've seen student loans has been quickly overtaking other categories and is now number two. We've got a broken system there. So credit card debt is the fourth largest source of household indebtedness. That's just revolving credit for things that you bought that are depreciating in value or have been used up or entertainment, just gone, but you still owe for it. Credit card debt has reached record levels in January 2009. So this is really going back to that financial crisis, the Great Recession. So 6 months into the financial crisis, coinciding with low interest rates and easy access to mortgage debt or mortgage credit, tighter access to credit since the crisis began has been a contributing factor to lower credit card debt since 2009. In addition, there were greater defaults, credit card payments, which resulted in greater increased write-offs by credit card companies due to higher unemployment and lower wages. And then we went through our whole COVID incident as well, COVID-19, and seeing how credit was affected. So credit card balances went down during COVID. People weren't out. First of all, they weren't out spending as much. Second of all, they were getting all the stimulus money, and they were using stimulus money instead of credit cards. And so after all that ran out, the credit card balances just started going up again. So this is just an example of, you know, what can take place in a crisis, but even beyond the crisis, habits don't change. Habits continue the same. Four, creditors became more lenient after the crisis, resulting in account balances, as I said, on credit cards rising tremendously after the crisis because the stimulus money is gone. Since consumers failed to learn from history and achieved a false sense of security, as consumer confidence rose and the economy improved after a Great Recession. Same has happened in COVID as well. You know, consumer confidence grows afterwards, stock market at all-time highs, but yet it's a false sense of security that people have. Oh, we can handle this. I mean, the government apparently is able to do it, so why can't we? Why can't we have all this debt? What are we at, 35... trillion now is our debt load, and we're adding to the deficit each year. Our spending is out of control, both on a national level and a household personal level. So here's due to COVID-19, average credit card balances have once again fallen, but this, as I said, was because of stimulus money. And what's the inevitable result? No one wanted to talk about this either. The inevitable result of printing money, pumping liquidity into the economy, the inevitable result is inflation. Because there's more money out there And so prices go up because there's more money floating around. And so we've pumped trillions of dollars into the economy, and it just resulted in more and more inflation. That was inevitable. And so different administrations will blame the next administration or the previous administration when everyone knew, without saying it, that the stimulus funds would create inflation. And we all saw the effects of that. But post-pandemic, credit card balances are again on the rise because that stimulus money has run out. So, not very encouraging, huh? Well, we'll move on to some biblical principles related to borrowing and lending. If we were to implement these principles, even on a national level, that would dramatically change things. But I wouldn't count on that happening on a national level, but we can apply these on a personal level. So let's just define debt. Very simple here. When applied to finances, debt is something that is owed, an obligation that must be repaid, or a state of owing something to someone else. For example, being deeply in debt. This typically refers to money that is borrowed and must be repaid. Very simple, straightforward, what debt is. The dictionary defines debt as money or property which one person is obligated to pay another. Notice there is an obligation there. And we're going to see that from Scripture. It's an obligation. Even debt owed to money owed to credit card companies, bank loans, money borrowed from relatives, the home mortgage, and past due medical bills. All owed to someone else for something we have received. So let's look at morality and debt. As we've already said, money in and of itself is neither moral nor immoral. It's not an evil thing. It's not necessarily a good thing. It's just amoral. There's no morality to it. It's a tool. So in the same way, debt in and of itself is morally neutral. It's a tool. It can be used for good or bad. And I know you're going to hear from people like Dave Ramsey, it's all evil. But that's not what Scripture really teaches. It's an instrument that can be used for good or evil. So even though debt is amoral, note the following caution from Burkett here. There's nothing unbiblical about borrowing money. Scripture does not prohibit borrowing. But there is not one positive reference to borrowing money in all of the Bible. All references to borrowing money are negative. Most of them are warnings because it can be misused so easily. Because of our hearts, the fallenness of our human hearts, we can tend to misuse debt very quickly. Point C, the moral issue enters the picture when it comes to the usage of money and debt. In other words, it is the usage of money and debt that is of concern because the usage defines the morality. Whether the usage of debt is wise or foolish. For example here, gold or any other precious metal in and of itself is a morally neutral object. It's neither good or bad, morally speaking. But a person's desire for gold and usage of the gold is the moral issue. A person can have lots of gold and not love it. Another person can have no gold and still love it. The reverse is also certainly true. A person can have lots of gold and love it, while another person can have no gold and not love it. Right? So it's what the condition of your heart is towards that object is really the issue, not the object itself. Someone with an improper view and abuse of debt falls into the category of the person that loves gold but doesn't have enough of it to feed his or her lusts. Be aware, because of that ungodly attitude can quickly and often does lead to financial bondage due to the improper use of debt and the false and deadly perception that credit cards are some form of gold. They are not. Observe when you get those credit card offers. What types of credit cards? Silver. Gold card. Platinum card. Titanium card. Even the black card. That's supposed to be the ultimate. But look, they associate the credit card with these precious metals to get you to think, I now possess something very valuable. It's precious and very useful to me, like as if it were an asset rather than a liability. But they are not forms of gold or silver or platinum or titanium or any other precious metal. Let's shift now to some warnings on the use and abuse of debt in the Bible. Deuteronomy 15:16. For the Lord your God will bless you as he has promised you, and you will lend to many nations, but you will not borrow. And you will rule over many nations, but they will not rule over you. A sign of power for a nation is the ability to lend to other nations who have need. That's a sign of power, a sign of strength. But if you've got to borrow from other countries, that's a sign of weakness, and they can easily rule over you. So borrowing would serve as a sign of weakness and lack of God's favor towards Israel if and when the nation disobeyed the law of Moses. Proverbs 22:7, the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. Now, the problem with that in the modern interpretation of it is that we go back to slavery, and we look at back in our country's history, and that type of slavery, very wicked form of slavery. Yes, sir. Well, all nations are borrowers versus, because we're borrowing to our future children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. We're all leveraged to one degree or another. I wouldn't say that there is a country with a lot of strength other than maybe some Middle Eastern countries who have that black gold in the ground, right? And so we do too, and hopefully we will get, and hopefully we will become, you know, energy independent once again. But that's, you know, you see those Middle Eastern countries, right? They're driving their Mercedes and their Bentleys, and they, you know, break down in the desert. What do? They just leave them there. They just leave them in the desert. They have so much money, they don't have to worry about it. And so they have a lot of control. You know, in today's world, those who control the price of oil control most of the economies of the world. So where's the U.S.? I mean, we have mortgaged our future so deeply to our great-great-great-grandchildren that we're not powerful, but, you know, we still have what the world wants as far as our military strength and what we export. So we're still a strong country in that sense, but we're just the strongest of the weak, if that makes sense. So Proverbs 22:7, so focusing then on the individual versus the nation, the rich rules over the poor and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. And as I was saying, that we tend to think of slavery in terms of our closest association to it in modern history in the U.S., or even we know that slave labor is going on throughout the world today. But don't think of that in terms in this context. This is simply saying that someone who borrows is really has an obligation to the person they borrowed it from. They are required to pay that back. So in a sense, they are a slave to the borrower. They have an obligation. And so those who are wealthy rule over the poor because they have that control over them. And as I've just said here, with its use, debt creates a financial obligation on the part of the borrower. Hence the word slave for the debtor, since he is or she is using someone else's money, property, and must pay it back to the lender. Okay? And so as I've said, be careful not to import the modern practice of slavery into the Old and New Testament contexts. Yes, sir. Yeah, you can certainly say that. It's you are less free. You,
yeah. Away from the slavery of old.
Yeah, and that's why I like to focus on it. It's an obligation, yeah. Right? And it does make you less free because now you've got to, you're obliged to repay that to someone. So slavery, of course, can and often was brutal. And we saw that in Egypt's treatment of Israel. You were slaves, and then the Lord freed them. But we could think of slavery in many contexts in the Old Testament and New Testament as a form of employment. Now, it's an obligated form of employment, but think of the poor man and think of the wealthy man who brings that poor man into his house and says, become a slave in my home. I will treat you well. I will provide for you. You can even have a family. There's a lot of, we can look at a lot of Old Testament passages, whether the person brought the family in or they acquired a wife and then they had children. There's different ways of treating that. But if it's a gracious master, this is a good relationship because the poor person is being cared for by the master, has the protection of the master, and so this could be a beneficial relationship for both. So freedom may or may not have been preferable, and it was not always possible to gain that freedom. Note the ordinances outlined in the Law of Moses concerning the treatment of a Hebrew slave owned by a fellow Hebrew in Exodus 21, verses 2 to 12. That is where you have the Hebrew slave is to serve for 6 years, but he was to go free in the seventh year. If it was a Hebrew owning another Hebrew. So it was a temporary condition. But in the seventh year, they were to be free. But if that slave says, I love my master and I want to stay here, that's where they took the awl and ran it through at the door, front door, basically connecting that person to that household, run it through the earlobe. And so they would choose voluntarily to become a permanent slave in that household because my owner cares for me, he's gracious, he loves me, and I am here to serve him, and my family is being cared for this. So think of that in a sense like that, that it could become permanent, but it was at the choice of the one who made that decision. Okay, so be careful about importing our modern understanding of slavery into these contexts and simply understand it creates an obligation when we owe something to someone else. If you look at the Apostle Paul, he neither condemned nor condoned the practice of slavery, but rather noted the obligation of a Christian slave to serve his master faithfully as a good testimony. And you can look at those passages there. Freedom from slavery was not mandatory, but it could be sought for whom it was possible. But Paul stressed the need to understand that God's providential plan allows for the condition of slavery, and therefore the duty of the slave is to remain faithful to his master. In other words, it's possible to live a God-honoring, obedient life as a slave because God continues to exercise his sovereign control, even under the most difficult of circumstances. It's hard for us to understand, right? In this nation where we prize our freedom, our independence, our autonomy, we just don't function that way in this country any longer. So let's look at another passage here, Psalm 37, 21. And notice the association here. The wicked borrows and does not pay back. It's not wicked that he borrows. The wickedness comes in that he does not pay back. His character is such that he does not pay back. But the righteous is gracious and gives. So different character, and that character comes out in different ways. So understand, it's not wicked here to borrow. It's wicked not to pay back. As we've said, debt creates not only a financial obligation, but it creates a moral obligation as well. So if you have the attitude, I just don't need to pay that debt back, what's the big deal? Nobody's going to come after me. I'm going to get out. The society doesn't really care. It's not a negative mark on my character. Well, you need to focus on what the Word of God says. So one of the characteristics of a wicked man is he borrows and he does not pay back. Do you want to be associated with the wicked man? by borrowing and not paying back. That's the characteristic, one of the characteristics of a wicked man. So in effect, he's stealing because he's taken something from someone with no intention of returning the borrowed property to the owner. Psalm 112, verses 1 through 6, praise the Lord. How blessed is the man who fears the Lord. So we're going to have a description of the man who fears the Lord. And you can see all of those positive characteristics here. And then we get down to, it is well with a man who is gracious and lends. So again, borrowing, lending is not an evil thing, because the man who fears the Lord can be described as a gracious man and a gracious man who lends to others. So if lending were an evil activity, why would that be described for the man who fears God? He may give, but he also may lend. Lend to the poor. So keep that in mind. That's why, you know, different kind of understanding of what you might hear regarding lending and borrowing. It can be characterized as a beneficial thing. Lending as well as giving to those in need is considered to be a moral virtue that characterizes the righteous man. But in Matthew, the words of Jesus himself, Matthew 5, give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. Again, a characteristic of the righteous man. He is a generous giver, and he will lend to others. He's open and willing to do that. So the righteous and gracious man either gives or lends to those in need. The conclusion is that lending can be a virtuous activity and can indicate the character of strength and kindness for those who are rich yet righteous. There are times when it's appropriate to lend and other times when it's appropriate to give, expecting nothing in return. So when those times are is going to be on an individual basis. Should I give to someone or should I lend to them? Well, it depends. A practical principle here would be give, not lend, to those who do not have the ability to pay back but are in genuine need. So general principle there. Someone who comes to me and says, hey, I'd like to borrow this, but you know they don't have the ability to pay back, just give it to them, right? If they are going to use it to meet needs. Versus maybe it would be best for their character to lend to them and have them repay. That would teach them diligence and patience and obligation and all those things. So it takes discernment to know when that situation might be. So be careful. Should I lend? Should I give? That would depend on the individual context and the person with whom you're dealing with. Moving on to number four here, what we call the prudent use of debt. We've already defined it as owing something to someone else, borrowing something from someone with the intention to return it with either with or without interest, depending on the arrangement. But debt creates an obligation on the part of the borrower to the lender. We've already said that. So the lender agrees to give use of his or her personal property, whether that be material things or physical objects or financially, and they say you can borrow this for a specific period of time with the expectation that you will return it to me in the same condition that it was in as when it was given. And in the case of money, the expectation is that the money borrowed will be returned along with a predetermined amount of interest according to the terms of the agreement. Pretty straightforward here. Then the borrower obligates himself or herself to return the property to the owner after a specific period of time. Don't use the property foolishly, not in a way that would cause damage to the property and resulting need for restitution to the owner. But in the case of money, the expectation is the money will not be used in a way that will be lost or unable to be recovered by the borrower. So, hey, I've got this great opportunity that I've heard about. If you just lend me this much money, it's guaranteed to double in 30 days, and I'll return your money. Okay? Run from that, right? That's not wise. So you must possess the ability to repay. prior to borrowing. If he foresees that he may not be able to repay in the future, it's better not to borrow. Better not to ask. Since debt creates an obligation, with its usage, the wise man will use it sparingly, knowing that he not only has a financial obligation, but also a moral obligation to repay what he owes. Even though the lender may be a faceless credit card company, the obligation to repay the debt remains the same. I'm not borrowing from a person. That credit card company is so big, so massive, they're not going to care whether I pay this back or not. Well, remember your not only your financial obligation, but your moral obligation. The lender without a face is still a lender. Burkett provides a fitting warning when he writes, "Remember, you can use credit cards less foolishly, but you rarely use a credit card wisely. So carefully consider how you handle your credit cards if you choose to possess and use them." And maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to the practical implications. Number five here, the admission to escape and avoid debt. Debt facts and considerations here. Dayton states, in recent years, more than 1 million individuals filed bankruptcy, more bankruptcies than during the Great Depression. Consumers now spend approximately $1 out of every $5 in take-home pay on personal debts. 20% of take-home pay, not including the mortgage. Financial tension is consistently cited as one of the reasons marriages end in divorce. Probably the number one reason for marital strife is money issues. It can be other things as well, but financial issues can really wreak havoc on a marriage. Number two, these statistics should serve as instant red flags to Christians whose testimony and ability to give are severely hampered by the burden of debt. If you're paying 20% of your take-home pay, plus whatever if you have a mortgage or rent, that's really going to hamper your ability to give. And so we're basically robbing in a sense because we're paying interest on debt instead of being free to provide financially for the needs of the church, for those in need, for the spread of the gospel, because we're spending so much on debt. So be careful of that. Christian marriages are also placed in jeopardy when the burden of debt results in strife and a breakdown in communication between husband and wife. Those who are married should never allow money issues to develop a wedge between the spouses, between each other. That can happen very easily, though. But set your trajectory on communicating well about these things and determining not to fall into unnecessary debt. B here, debt fallacies and corrections. As I mentioned earlier, you have to transform your thinking from a short-term payment mentality, because that's what we're told. Can you afford the payment? We're bombarded with that. You got to transform that into a long-term total cost mentality. And now when you take out a mortgage or an auto loan, now there are requirements that they have to provide you with the total amount you're going to pay. So be sure to pay attention to that. So that was a good law for providing that information. Yes?
Is that law a California law or a nationwide law?
I think that's a nationwide law. So you got to transform into a total cost. What am I paying in total for this thing that I am purchasing with on debt? You cannot afford to live a lifestyle if you're living on a payment mentality. Payments quickly add up and easily overtake you. Second here, the misuse of debt is often based on the false premise that God will provide no matter what happens. But that's a presumptuous sin. We use debt to finance or indulge our wants and desires, especially when we do that. Well, God's going to provide, right? He promised to. Well, there are also implications for foolish activity, foolish decisions. there's going to be consequences for the decisions that we make if we choose to indulge ourselves versus being wise. Now, I want to be careful on this statement, too, because I know that there can be situations where debt may be, in a sense, unavoidable due to situations out of control, but I'm talking about really that consumer debt mentality here. For the believer, it is improbable that a person would ever need to utilize debt in order to provide for his or her genuine needs. God didn't say, I'll provide for you, but you're going to have to use some debt to get those needs covered. That daily food, clothing, you're going to have to use debt to get that covered. Typically, that's not going to be the case to cover those genuine needs. So it's even more improbable that the Lord would ever use debt to provide for these needs when he's the owner of every resource that has ever been created. He does not need to borrow to supply your needs. So if you're in a situation where, oh, we're heavily in debt, it's probably not because you were just funding genuine needs. You're most likely funding unnecessary wants and fulfilling unnecessary desires. So I want you to be sure you see that in the right perspective. Number three, the misuse of debt is also based on a misperception that the way in which a person uses debt is not a moral issue. Again, having that idea that it's not really a sin issue whether or not I pay this back, well, that's not true. It is a moral issue. And you've created not only a financial obligation, but a moral obligation when you borrow. Indifference characterizes those who care not whether they pay their bills on time. They often view bankruptcy as an acceptable parachute to get out of debt when the overspending plane goes down. Just don't care. Doesn't matter. Doesn't affect my sanctification. It's separate. It's compartmentalized. It's outside of my pursuit of holiness. Well, that's not true. God expects and commands that debts are to be repaid, and therefore debt and its repayment should be taken seriously by Christians. God's word demands it, and an untarnished testimony depends on it. It is most certainly a moral issue. Number four, unnecessary and burdensome debt is a result of falsely placing self at the center of one's affections instead of God. Could a heavy debt load could indicate a lack of trust in God as provider, as well as an imbalanced focus on material things or covetousness. And at the center of all that, the bottom of that is its idolatry, worship of a false god and expression of love for the world. 1 John 2:15-17. Very clear here. Do not love the world nor the things of the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, and these are all can be tied to this whole debt issue and things that we acquire with debt. It's because the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life is not from the Father, but is from the world. The world is passing away, and also its lust, but the one who does the will of God lives forever. So, certainly we can turn those things that we want, it can create covetousness in our hearts and idolatry in our hearts. As Jesus said, you cannot love both God and mammon. You're going to love one or the other. You're going to hate one or the other. You cannot love both God and money. You can't do it. Another sometimes touchy here. People come and ask me from time to time, should I co-sign this loan? That may be different in a household, like for child, but you do want to teach them wisdom when it comes to concerning this. If you make the choice to co-sign or guarantee a loan for another person, you also make the choice to become legally and morally responsible to pay that back. Co-signing, you're saying, I'm immediately responsible. A guarantee says, well, if that person defaults, I will become the responsible person to pay that back. So if you're doing that, it's most often because that individual doesn't have the ability to pay that back, and it's going to come back on you. Or that person or individual has not taken the time to develop a good credit rating, a good credit score, history of being patient. So rather than co-signing, if someone is in genuine need, give to them or lend to them. But most often that's not the case when people co-sign for a loan or become a guarantor for a loan. It's probably because they can't afford it when that happens. And so probably better for them not to make that purchase at all. There may be exceptions. There may be some, but we have to be very careful, especially when we look at B here. This fact, a study by the Federal Trade Commission found that 75% of those who co-signed for loans ended up making payments. 3/4 of the time, you're going to end up making those payments. Again, why? Because that person could not afford what they bought on credit. So be very careful. And Scripture, beyond the FTC, a much higher authority, Scripture gives clear warning against the practice of co-signing or guaranteeing. Proverbs 11:15, he who is a guarantor for a stranger will surely suffer for it, but he who hates being a guarantor is secure. Proverbs 17:18, a man lacking in sense pledges and becomes guarantor in the presence of his neighbor. So you lack sense if you do this. You're going to suffer for it if you do this. So there's warnings here. There's even more warnings. Proverbs 22, 26, and 27. Do not be among those who give pledges, among those who become guarantors for debts. If you have nothing with which to pay, why should he take your bed from under you? So maybe you're going to lose out if you become a guarantor for someone else who fails to repay. Now it's your obligation. The lender comes to collect, and now he's coming to your door. Well, I'll just take your bed because the other guy doesn't have anything, and you're listed as the guarantor. So I'm going to take from you. Solomon to his son, Proverbs 6, 1 through 5. My son, if you have become surety for your neighbor, have given a pledge for a stranger, if you have been snared with the words of your mouth, have been caught with the words of your mouth, do this then, my son, and deliver yourself. Since you have come into the hand of your neighbor, go, humble yourself, and inopportune your neighbor. Give no sleep to your eyes, no slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hunter's hand and like a bird from the hand of the fowler. Pretty strong warning, pretty stern warning there. Let's move on to, very quickly, just three slides here we're going to talk about. Because we're talking about owing, right? We're mainly talking about debt, but we also owe taxes. And so let's look at some very quick passages here, very quick time spent on these passages. So Jesus himself, some people will come up and say, I'm not going to pay taxes. That's not right. It's not constitutional. Well, okay, well, let's look and see what Jesus had to say about that. Luke 20, they questioned him saying, Teacher, we know that you speak and teach correctly, and you are not partial to any, but teach the way of God in truth. Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not? But he detected their trickery and said to them, Show me a denarius. Whose likeness and inscription does it have? They said, Caesar's. He said to them, Then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. Government has a certain amount of authority, and obviously we saw through the COVID, they overstepped that authority on imposing restrictions on worship for churches. Thankfully, this church stood up to that because that was not the realm of Caesar. But the thing that are in the realm of Caesar, we're obligated to pay. So we are obligated to pay taxes. Paul endorsed paying taxes. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. There is no authority except that which is established by God. And just jumping down there, for because of this you also pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing, render to all what is due to them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Now, it doesn't say there, well, if the government is corrupt, you don't have to pay. If the government's taking too much, you don't have to pay. Right? Did Paul live in a time where the government was corrupt and they took more than they should? Yeah. He says, you should pay. You need to pay. It's not the level of corruption that determines whether you pay or not. I know we all don't like that. We don't like that. But we are to pay taxes. Now, there's way, you know, would we all in here say, well, there's way too many taxes, there's too much taxes, the tax rates are too high. We'd all probably argue that, but that's not the question, right? We have an obligation to pay. Yes? I don't like the word finagle, lower taxes. But we can certainly use the clear IRS rules and laws to pay the lowest amount of taxes possible. There are tax strategies to do that, absolutely, and the IRS allows that. One related to giving, and I know this is a side note, but if you have an IRA, you have a 401k, and you roll over to an IRA, when you turn 70 and a half, the IRS says, you have to, well, it's like age 70, 374. We have to take required minimum distributions. Basically, the government said, the IRS has said, you've deferred tax on these contributions that you've made to your 401k or your IRA, but we want our pound of flesh. We want to receive taxes at some point. So when you start taking distributions from that account, you have to pay taxes on it. But the IRS has part of the code, the tax code, that you, when you reach age 70 and a half, you can use those funds for your charitable giving. So rather than you taking the funds out, paying the tax on them, and then giving the after-tax amount to a charity, you can give it directly from your IRA to a charitable organization. And so that's one way to lower your taxable income, to reduce your taxes. Now, I'm just kind of giving that out. I'm just throwing that out there, and there's more to that. But that's just a way of saying, being wise, using the tax code to your advantage that is not unlawful, but it is reducing your taxable income. If you didn't do that, you'd be paying more in taxes unnecessarily. If you have, you know, we all want to be giving. So you can do that. That's just one way. So finagle, no, but within the IRS rules and regulations, there are certain ways to reduce your taxes, and that's wise to do, to reduce your taxes as much as you can legally. Now, I'm not talking, you know, offshore accounts and avoidance like that, but working within the system in which we have. So, yes, I would say, you know, work to reduce your taxes as much as you can, but in a legal and ethical way. Finally here, Peter endorsed submission to the governing authority. Submit yourselves to the Lord's sake, for the Lord's sake, to every human institution. So I just want to, you know, give the words of Christ, the words of Paul, the words of Peter, just saying how that argument that we should pay taxes, we're not obligated to, is a false argument. Okay, so I'm not going to spend a lot more time on that, but I do want to shift now to some practical advice on borrowing and debt. And these are general rules of thumb. And as I've said, I understand we're not all able to do this, but this should be our kind of our ideal, our goal, what we aim for. So use debt only for financing appreciating assets with a solid historical track record of appreciation over assets that will produce an income. The value of this item should be greater than or equal to the cost of the loan. So in other words, again, buy a house, we have a large mortgage on it, but historically, property like that, personal property, appreciates in value. So over time, hopefully the value of that is more than what you paid to borrow it. So that can be a judicious use of borrowing. Even then, consider paying off the debts as quickly as possible. Also be aware of the interest rate you're being charged on your debt and avoid exorbitant rates at all costs. So be aware on what you're paying in interest, what your interest rate is and how much you're going to be paying for whatever you are borrowing on. Number two, here's some examples in which debt may be used, but the wisdom of each circumstance should be evaluated on an individual basis. As I've said already, using debt to purchase a home. And so you want to apply Proverbs 24:3 if you are going to use debt to finance a home, and realizing that virtually all of us, probably 100% of us, could not purchase a home in today's market without some form of debt, if we can even do that at all. But Proverbs 24:3, by wisdom a house is built, and by understanding it is established. So use wisdom in this situation. Some facts and warnings. Housing, principal and interest, property taxes, homeowners insurance, maintenance is typically the largest category of expense in family budget, with a mortgage at the top of the list. Just be aware the American dream of home ownership is not a necessity and is not guaranteed in the Bible. So we're told, you know, the great American dream is to own a home, and many of us want to do that and are able to do that, but some who are not able to shouldn't feel like, oh, I'm necessarily missing out if you can't afford it. So it's not sinful to desire to own a home. It can certainly be a blessing, but also that can turn into an idol of the heart, right? As Proverbs 24:3, we've already read that, by wisdom a house is built and by understanding it is established. As that states, the decision to use debt in order to obtain housing requires wisdom and understanding in order to avoid making a foolish decision that places you in a position of living beyond your means instead of within your means. So if the Lord has blessed you to such a degree that you have the income to handle those payments and you're buying wisely, then be sure that you are living within your means if you choose to do that and have the ability to do that. Practical wisdom here. Don't be unwise in your use of mortgage debt. Don't allow yourself to purchase a home that is more than you can afford. Like a deep hole, debt is easy to fall into, but may be nearly impossible to get out of without a significant amount of help. Rather, learn to live within your means. We recently sold our home after we came off the mission field in 2013. We lived with Natalie's mom for a couple of years, and the Lord provided a home for us to purchase, and we made sure that we wanted to purchase it within our means, so we didn't go beyond what we could afford. And then just recently, we sold that home and purchased another one. And I ran the numbers so many different ways to make sure, can we afford this? Are we living within our means? Lord, is this okay with you? I just prayed about it and sought the Lord's wisdom. And only time will tell if that was a wise decision or not, but we're not living beyond our means to do that. And so, but we're also not living in a luxurious, huge home. You know, we're living in what the Lord has provided within our income. And so we're thankful for that. But we don't want to turn that home into an idol. We definitely want to see it as the Lord's home and use it in a way that would glorify and honor Him, and always give thanks for that. But that was, you know, just, I wanted to be wise and make sure, Lord, am I doing this? And am I doing this in a way that would honor you? And are we living within our means? And I just came to the conclusion that, yes, we are. And we agreed to make that purchase. So, but it took a lot of thought and process. We didn't enter into it rashly or unwisely or foolishly. But also here, give careful consideration to the total amount that you'll pay out of your pocket for your home when it's finally paid off. Look at those numbers that are now provided if you get the mortgage loan. Not just the affordability of the monthly payment. What are we going to actually be paying for this? And in the end, if history is any indicator, is it going to increase in value beyond what we paid for it, even with the interest included? Another one here, a little play on words here. Cut off your arms. Okay, adjustable rate mortgages. Now we're getting into really some of the very practical here. Cut off your arms and then get fixed. So when it comes to mortgages, if we're talking about borrowing to purchase a home, don't fall into the trap of getting an adjustable rate mortgage, which could really quickly increase in the interest rate could increase and cause you to be living well beyond your means because you're not able to make those payments. Always get a fixed rate mortgage. And now, you know, I just talked about buying a home and rates are really high right now. But we want to make sure that whatever the rate was, we could afford that. And with the hope, but not the guarantee, that we will maybe refinance in the future at a lower rate. And just use wisdom when it comes to that. But if we couldn't afford it now, we shouldn't be buying it now. Not with depending on those rates going down. And although this may sound radical, for the married couple committed to implementing biblical principles, the amount spent on housing expenses on a monthly basis and all other expenses for that matter should be based on one income, the husband's. And you're probably going, that's impossible. That's impossible. I've been living in California since 1998, and we got married in 2000. And when we determined on the Lord's providence to have children, we went down to just my one income. And we have lived on that ever since. And so we made that determination, and the Lord provided, which meant we weren't going to be in the most expensive house or live in the most expensive neighborhood or drive the most expensive cars. We said, this is our means. This is what we're going to live under. And I don't even know what it would be like today to start out as a young couple, just married, and trying to figure that out. But you know, somebody could have told me, well, that's impossible, you know, 25 years ago. That's impossible. But it wasn't. We made that determination. Now, whether or not that's possible today, that's a challenge, definitely a challenge, particularly here in Southern California and the price of homes. So take that as you will. Take that as you will. E, although the time frame in the following statement may be extended beyond 12 years, we're going to look at a statement from Larry Briquette, particularly for us in Southern California, and this was written many years ago, but still, the principle's there. Most couples would be advised to buy a small home the first time. Even a small home, I realize, in Southern California can be a very, very expensive home. Put their time and effort into it and use that as seed money for the next one. By exercising self-discipline and good planning, most couples can buy or own a home debt-free in about 12 years. Well, I don't know about that anymore. This was about over 30 years ago when this was written.
Did you say 30?
This was written, yeah, like,
30 years ago?
Yeah, oh yeah.
That's a big difference.
Yeah, I understand that. But the principle's still there of, you know, not buying beyond your means, buying something smaller, and then building over time, seeing that value increase, paying down that debt, and then moving on to maybe the next larger home. But many tend to just want to get right into that family-sized, full-sized home right away because we want to start a family, but that can be detrimental because you may be living beyond your means. So don't buy a home that's too large initially, but rather start small and build. That's really the principle here. Whether you can pay it off in 12 years or not, well, I don't think that's going to happen, but it just depends, I suppose. Next here, handle debt like a live hand grenade. Get rid of it as soon as possible before it blows up. View the debt as a potentially destructive weapon that could therefore be unwise to hold on to for a long period of time. So, you know, have that aversion to debt. Just develop that mentality that it's not the best to take advantage of easy credit just because it's offered to you. So as long as the pin is in, you're relatively safe, but the pin is removed. And here I'm giving an analogy to a job loss, disability, salary cuts. No small amount of financial devastation is sure to follow for those who are overburdened and eventually experience the explosive nature of debt. So you may be able to handle it today, but you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow if you're living beyond your means here and you borrow too much. When it comes to purchasing a home, don't borrow money for a down payment. Save for it. It's just too challenging and beyond your reach. Continue to rent and be content. Family member gives you the money for down payment, that's acceptable, but don't borrow the money for it. So don't depend on others to feed your out-of-reach housing desires, especially if you're a young couple. And if you can, learn to live on one income from the start. Highly recommend that. Highly recommend that. Number three, give careful consideration prior to using credit to finance depreciating assets, as we already talked about. Auto loans may be a necessity, but rarely do they make financial sense. So strictly from a financial sense, you're saying this car is a depreciating asset and I'm borrowing to buy a depreciating asset. Just financially, it's not the best use of your funds, although it may be necessary. I'm just saying just realize what's going on there. Avoid those no money down, 0% loans that entices you. Rather save for it. I'm going to go through these rather quickly as we only have a limited amount of time here. So principle for money, for purchases, if you don't have the money to pay for it now, don't buy it. Seems pretty straightforward, doesn't it? But that's not the advice we're given today. You don't have the money for it, just put it on credit. You can have it now. Prayerfully seek the Lord. If it's a genuine need, he's going to provide for it. If it's simply a want, he may not. God's love is often expressed in withholding rather than in giving because he knows our hearts and our hearts are easily turned to worship the creation rather than the creator. So just consider the Lord's withholding something from you may be an expression of love to you. Remember, even if you have it all, you may end up having nothing. We all know of extremely wealthy people in this world that are miserable and a wreck. They have it all, but yet they have nothing, especially if they are unbelievers, right? They have nothing. They may have everything in this world, but they may end up with nothing in the spiritual realm. Four, don't deceive yourself into believing that that object you wish to acquire is a need when it really is a want. That's easy for us to do. We're easily self-deceived. That's really, I gotta have that. That's really a necessity. When it's actually, it's just a want. It's just a desire. And you may already have something that functions just as well. Phone, car, house, items of clothing, whatever it may be. And although it's a revolutionary concept, a little bit sarcastic here, the simple way to acquire an object is to save for it, then pay for it. Pretty radical, huh? Very radical. But God may provide for something in an unexpected way, but don't presume on his goodness and generosity, especially if you have a sinful, coveting heart towards an object, which leads you to idolatry. Another practical thing here, number four, it is wise and highly recommended to monitor your credit due to the increase of fraud and identity theft. Consider also freezing your credit. Some of you may not have heard of that before, where you actually freeze your credit with the three major credit reporting agencies. So no illegal fraudulent credit can be opened unless you unfreeze your credit. You can do a simple search online for Clark, freeze credit. Just put those three words in. It's going to come up with Howard Clark, and he's got a credit freeze and thaw guide. So very practical thing that you should do. So be aware if you do that, if you freeze your credits and you go out and apply for a loan, they're going to say, we can't check your credits because it's frozen. You're going to have to unfreeze that. Which is possible. You can actually do that on your smartphone with the apps, with Experian and the other two credit reporting agencies. But just a practical thing to help protect your credit from someone getting and opening some type of account without your knowledge. That's going to help you. Okay, so just very practical. Yeah.
Every time
Yes.
Also $20, and I need pressure from a cashier. And I'm sorry, everything's frozen. I just can't.
Yeah. Yes. So.
But if you apply right now, even if it gets declined, you'll still get such and such.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Those retail stores where they want you to open that credit card, you'll get an instant discount if you do it. Yeah, but if your credit's frozen, it just creates a wall there for you. You're not going to fall to that temptation. You shouldn't anyway, but that can be an extra hedge of protection for you. Sorry, my credit's frozen. Can't do it.
Is there a small fee for that freeze?
No, there's no fees at all for this. No fees at all. You can freeze and unfreeze it. Like when we applied for our last mortgage, they said, oh, your credit's frozen. I'm like, okay, well, I can just go in right now. I'll unfreeze it, put a temporary time frame in. You go in today, you check my credit, it's going to be frozen again tomorrow. And so it's that simple to do.
On all three?
So, yes, on all three. Yep. Does it affect your credit score? It does not affect your credit score. Not at all. Not at all. Does not affect your credit score. Just remember, if you're going to open a new credit card or take a loan out on a car or mortgage, you have to unfreeze that credit so that they can check your credit. So that's a very practical thing there.
Oh,
yes, yes, sir.
There's another thing online with the credit bureaus where you can say that you think that your credit, you can put on like a one-year temporary note that you might be the subject of a fraud. That's another thing.
Yeah, so you put a note
does that need to, because that's set for, I think, a year, right, for a temporary, where you don't have to give them any documentation that you've actually been the subject of fraud. But would that have any bearing on being able to, open a new line of credit?
It shouldn't affect. So if you put a note on that's, I've been maybe a victim of fraud, and... would that affect your ability to open new credit? Is that really the question?
Yes, sir.
Then? Yeah, it shouldn't. They may just have more hoops for you to jump through. But as long as they can check your credit, then you should be okay. Yes, sir?
Do you trust the online resources for checking your credit?
Do I trust them? Like, what do you mean the online resources?
The people that you would give information to take a look at.
Yeah, you got to know who you're dealing with. If you they run a credit check on you. I mean, if it's a mortgage, obviously you want to be working with a reputable company that's going to be checking your credit. But you've got to be careful with that. Obviously, you don't want to just let anybody give the information so that they, if they're a reputable company, they have the ability to check, and then you're going to get a letter saying this company checked your credit, so you know who did it and when. So if you get a letter and I didn't give authorization for this, I did not seek to open this credit, then you know that somebody's trying to do something fraudulent. So you can be careful with that. All right, very quickly, because I know we're basically out of time, I have some of these non-negotiable principles of credit card use. So I talked about that earlier. Maybe we get to that at the end. So these are my personal non-negotiable principles. I'll use credit cards, but only under these conditions. Number one, only purchase items that you already have the money to pay for. It's already in your account. It's already accounted for within your budget. So you can use credit card for that. So this avoid purchasing impulses items on credit. This can be challenging. Number two, and you'll get these on the slides if you look them up, after these are posted, when the audio is posted on grace.org, gracechurch.org. Number two, pay off the balance entirely every month prior to your payment due date. Never pay just the minimum payment and never carry a balance or pay interest. Honestly, I don't even care what the interest rate is on my credit cards because I never use it. I don't care if it's 20%. Now, I don't say that nonchalantly, but honestly, because I'm not using it, it doesn't matter. Right? But if you're utilizing the credit or the interest, then yeah, you've got to be aware of that. But that's another principle for me, is paying off the balance every single month. If I've already accounted for the money that is already in my account, it's already in the budget to pay for that, then I'll just pay it off every month, and I will never carry a balance I'll never pay interest. The time you do that, you perform plastic surgery. Cut those credit cards. So if you violate these principles, cut up the credit cards. Number three, don't spend any more than you would spend if you're using cash or debit cards. I know Dave Ramsey's big on that. Oh, if you're using debit cards or cash, you're not going to spend as much. Well, you can develop a habit of not spending more by using credit card if you're disciplined. Most people do tend to spend more with a credit card, though, versus a debit card or cash. But if you develop a good discipline and you're only buying what you'd already planned to buy within your budget and you have the money for it, then you can use credit cards. If you can't do that, don't use them. Four, this is kind of optional, use a credit card that pays you for using it instead of you paying them. All our credit cards have some form of cash rewards on them. They're paying us while 99.9999% of their other cardholders are paying interest. They're paying us. We're getting those rewards. And we're not spending just to get the rewards, but hey, if they're going to pay us back, you know, I'm the customer that they don't want. They don't want to pay. They want me to pay them. But if they're going to offer that kind of reward, I'm going to take advantage of that. And so those credit cards are paying us to use their credit cards. And I'm only using it to pay on what I've already predetermined to purchase, money that I already have in my account, paying off the balance every single month. Okay? So if a person breaks any of the first three, the fourth one's optional, you should cut up your credit cards and use cash, checks, or debit cards only. Many people just don't have the discipline to avoid making unnecessary purchases, so just better not to use them. If you can keep those disciplines in line and in order, then for me, it's fine. I think it's okay. But a lot of people just can't handle that. So, temptation's too great. Wisdom dictates best to avoid the use of credit cards altogether. They are can be very convenient to use, and that's one reason why we use them, but we have those disciplines in place. Keep the guardrails on in order to avoid crashing. So, very important. You might have the prestige of pulling out that Visa signature card, but is it really worth it if you're not able to be well disciplined? Yes, sir.
So long as you're following these rules, can I use a credit card frequently to boost my credit?
Sure.
So long as you're following these rules.
Yeah, I think you can. I know Dave Ramsey doesn't care about your credit rating, but in reality, you should. You should. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, there's many different parameters that they look at when looking at developing your credit score. Probably not best not to go into that right now because I think we're really out of time. But it's a good question, and a lot of that you can actually get on your app for your credit card, and they're going to list all the ways. Or when you look at your credit report, you know, go to I believe it's freecreditreport.com. Is that right?
Yeah.
There's ones you don't want to use that are very similar to that, but you can check your credit, check with the three different credit reporting agencies. You can check for free. Maybe it's Annual Free Credit. Just be sure you look at the right one, because I don't want to get in trouble with, oh, I used the wrong one and they charged me to look at my credit. So anyway, that's where I'm going to end today. I know we went a few minutes over, but this is a very important topic, and I know kind of a heavy topic. But hopefully it's been beneficial for you, and the Lord will use it to live more wisely when it comes to debt. So next week we're going to have our last session, and it's going to be on growing, so saving and investing. So I think you'll want to be here to get a more biblical perspective on that. So let me close this with prayer. Heavenly Father, it's been good to be together. It's always insightful and encouraging to look at your word, because we know that if we live by your promises and your principles, you will bless that. And so we want to endeavor to live in such a way that we are faithful stewards in the realm of debts and on all the other uses of money. So give us that wisdom that you provide freely to those who ask. And I just pray for everyone in here that they would take advantage of that free wisdom from you. We pray this in your name. Amen.